Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times Supplementary Log. Interviews with the authors and musicians that make Simultaneous Times podcast possible. You've heard the stories and the music. Now hear the stories behind the stories.
Welcome to Simultaneous Times Supplementary Log, an interview with DJ Butler. DJ, or Dave Butler, has been a lawyer, a consultant, an editor, and a corporate trainer. His novels include Witchy Eye, Witchy Winter, and Witchy Kingdom from Bane Books, as well as the forthcoming modern fantasy novel, The Cunning Man. He also writes for children, the steampunk fantasy adventure tales, The Kidnap Plot, The Giant Seat, and The Library Machine are published by Knopf. Other novels include City of the Saints from Wordfire Press. Dave also organizes writing retreats and anarcho-libertarian writers' events, and travels the country with the Bard's Tower to sell books. He plays guitar and banjo whenever he can, and likes to hang out in Utah with his children. What was your first experience with science fiction and fantasy, and what inspired you to first create work in the genre?
I love the way you phrase that question, because the answer, you're asking them like two questions, but actually the answer is really the same. So my father was an academic, he's retired, and he would travel to conferences and bring back gifts for the kids, you know. And when I was 7 years old, he brought me the 25th anniversary Silver Jubilee edition of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, the four-book paperback set in a single box with Daryl K. Sweet covers. And I thought that that was the most amazing thing I'd ever read. I didn't get out of bed for a week, basically. I almost burned the house down because I fell asleep one night reading with the lamp clipped to the headboard next to me on. And during the night, the joint of the lamp just softened a little bit and the lamp leaned forward against the pillow. So when I woke up in the morning, there was a hole burnt in my pillowcase. And in a little, another hour of sleep, I would have lit the pillow on fire. So I was 7 years old. I read The Lord of the Rings. It was way over my head. And I said, I really only want to read this stuff. And I really want to write this stuff. So I spent a lot of years trying to refine Tolkien, to have that same experience again of finding that magic. And candidly, you never do. First of all, nobody is Tolkien, even though a lot of fantasy being written at the time was highly derivative, highly imitative. You know, Terry Brooks really found his own voice, but not in book one. Sword of Shannara is a straight Tolkien ripoff. But of course, you don't find Tolkien again, but you find lots of other wonderful things. You find Terry Brooks, and you find Raymond Feist, and you find other writers. And I always thought I'd be a writer, and I'd always thought I'd be a writer in the vein of Tolkien, doing something like Tolkien did. But then I wanted to get married, and I chickened out. I wanted a career. And so I went to law school, and I was a lawyer for 11 years plus. Technically, I'm still a lawyer now. I don't practice law at all. But then in 2010, a magical thing happened, which was I got fired, and I decided I was going to write. And actually, I'm doing now what I thought I would do when I was 7 years old, which is I'm trying to be Tolkien. The Lord of the Rings is deeply spiritual. It's rooted in Tolkien's spirituality as well as in Germanic language, and it's also deeply English, and it's deeply Tolkien. And it's an idiosyncratic Tolkien mythology of his native country. And that is absolutely what I am trying to do. Only my native country is America. So it's the Witchy War, three books are out now, is my American answer to Tolkien. It is a spiritual, mythological kind of prehistory or alternate history of America. So I am quite literally living my seven-year-old dream.
And I imagine your family is supportive as well.
Yeah, my family's okay. You know, a lot of things have happened on the road. I'm still making a living doing things other than writing. I am a corporate trainer, and that takes a significant amount of time. But my family is supportive. I'm able to find time to write because of their help. Kids are excited. They learn about kind of publishing lore and how it works, right, and from the inside, which is neat. They know the terminology. You know, my son, when he was 12, went to school bragging that he got to read an advanced reader copy of Brandon Sanderson's Steelheart. And the other kids didn't know what an advanced reader copy was, so he showed them because I brought it home. One of the really cool things that happened, maybe the coolest thing that happened along the way, is that my wife decided to become a writer as well. So, you know, I think when I got an agent very quickly and then seemed initially very close, all those ups and downs, right? So it seemed like I was going to catch fire right out of the bat, right out of the gate, and then I didn't. But in any case, I got an agent quickly, and it seemed like success was happening in it. And then I think she said, well, I can do that, you know. Anything you can do, I can do, right? And she did. So she went out, she has her own agent, and she got her first book came out from Random House last January, and her next one's scheduled to come out, we think, early 2020. So it's become a family business, and the whole family is aware of it, and Emily and I are both writing.
And aside from some of the books you mentioned that inspired you to start writing, what are some of your favorite science fiction, fantasy books and films?
So I got to meet one of my heroes last year, and I actually got to spend some time with him about 2 weeks ago. And there's a guy named Tim Powers. Tim's actually a California writer. He lives up near San Bernardino. And when I was a kid, I encountered this book called The Drawing of the Dark. And The Drawing of the Dark is set at the Siege of Vienna by the Ottomans. And it's about an Irish mercenary named Brian Duffy who meets this kind of crazy kind of alchemist working with the gunners. And people are trying to kill him. And it turns out that Brian Duffy is the reincarnation of King Arthur. And it turns out that the foundation of Western civilization is a beer called the Dark. And it is brewed in a tank that rests on an ancient grave of some unknown ur-cultural hero. In fact, it's that person, at least is the implication, who was later reincarnated as King Arthur and who now, 800 years later, has been reincarnated as Brian Duffy, this mercenary. And the tide of Western civilization is every 800 years when a new batch of the Dark is ready to be drawn, the forces of evil rise to try to defeat the civilization, right? And so the hero is reincarnated again to fight them off. So it's this completely insane book that blends Arthurian hero with this kind of basic interesting idea that beer is one of the basic drivers of civilization with the real history of the Turkish siege of Vienna. And I read this book when I was a kid, back when I was, you know, exploring, trying to find more Tolkien's. And I said, this is amazing. And I went to the library to try to find more Tim Powers books, and there weren't any. And I thought, oh, one-hit wonder. You know, this happens in fantasy. It's really sad. Terrible, you know. And then I didn't look for him again for a long time. So it must have been like 1982 or 83 I read that book. And then long about 2004, so 20 years later, I was revisiting a lot of the books I had read as a kid, which is really interesting because you do that, and some of them hold up well, and they're as good as you remembered or better. And some of them are not. Some of them you're like, okay, I enjoyed them because whatever, it was fun. But looking at it now, I say, oh, okay, that's not what I remember. But I looked up Tim Powers. I'd never forgotten the book, and he had a whole bunch of books now, right? And it turns out that all of his books are kind of like The Drawing of the Dark in that they are all secret histories. They all nestle inside real-world history, and they connect to sort of strange real-world events and explain them by means of mysterious demons or magic. And he's got, I don't know how many, 15 maybe novels or 20. One of my favorites is called Declare, which is about the Cambridge spy ring, right? Traitors to the Soviets, British traitors to the Soviets. But it's also mixed in with Mount Ararat and the djinns who were trapped up there with Noah's Ark. But the one readers will actually know, there's a Tim Powers book that you probably know without realizing it, which is his book On Stranger Tides. Disney took it and was making it into a Pirates of the Caribbean film without his permission. And this is, I think I understand this all correctly. He went after them with the lawyer, and they said, okay, yeah, you're right, it is your book. Paid him and put the title on. So the Disney on the Pirates of the Caribbean film, in which there's Blackbeard and the Fountain of Youth, is actually Tim Powers novel, a standalone fantasy novel that's been worked into Pirates franchise. So Tolkien aside, Tim is my absolute favorite. I love Neal Stephenson's stuff. My favorite Neal Stephenson is not his most famous. I love his Baroque cycle, which is actually set in the 17th century and is sort of about the invention of calculus and also formal logic and mechanical thinking devices. And it's wrapped around ideas around alchemy and the battle between Sir Isaac Newton at the head of the English Mint and a forger named Half-Cock Jack. And it's not his most famous, but I love it. Both Stevenson, with his love of big ideas, and maybe in particular that setting in the Baroque 1600s and 1700s, and Tim Power's love of secret histories are a huge influence on my writing, and in particular on The Witchy War, which is an alternate history fantasy set in an 1800s America.
So tell us a little bit about your writing process, and also lately you've been collaborating on novels. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
I wish I could say better things about my writing process. There have been periods of my life when I have a very regular habit, and I love that, and I hope to get back to it because it's a healthy way to live. You get up and I get the kids off to school, and then I write for 4 hours, and depending on the actually I would start by looking at yesterday's writing and revising that, and that would be in the mood, and then I would write today's pages, and how many pages depended on, basically it's a chapter or half a chapter, so it would be 8 or maybe 12 or 15 pages a day. Easy, done, written by 11 o'clock, and then I have time for marketing and social media and all that other kind of stuff. I don't live that way now because of my corporate training is very cyclical and very seasonal. So I write in spurts. So it tends to be the case that I don't write for a couple months, and then I work really hard to get a book out in a short period, you know, 2 months or 4 months. I'm trying to write a book. I've written 20% of a book that's probably 200,000 words long. I need to try and finish it by the end of the year now. So, in fact, September and October are really busy. So, in November and December, I'm going to try to write 180,000 words. So, that means process becomes very collapsed together, you know. I'm always reading, trying to fill my head and my heart with ideas, with material that would get churned up and turned into the writing. Usually, my outlining is just a matter of when I know the first fifth of the story, and I know the main kind of action climaxes, and I know what I want to have happen at the end. So I don't just know what I've outlined, that I've written down in a document. Then I'll start writing, and usually the outline, I fill in the outline as I go, maybe two chapters ahead of where I'm actually writing. So usually there's enough structure there up front to keep me from going crazy. And I usually end up with a really pretty good first draft. Not as good as when I was able to sit down and edit each day's writing before starting the new days, you know. So it's a little more chaotic than I'd like. So I've co-written now two books with Aaron Michael Ritchie, who's a Colorado writer. And this required me to adopt a different kind of process. And the reason is there are different ways to co-write. The way we did it is we each wrote half the first draft. And it wasn't first half, second half. It was some chapters here, some chapters there. And the way it ended up, although this was not by design in the first book, was that I would follow certain plot threads through and write them, and he would follow certain plot threads through and write them. And since there was more than one point of view, there were certain point of views that he wrote them all, right? And certain ones that I wrote them all. And this is a recipe for complete disaster unless you know what the book is going to be when you start writing. So this required us to have a process of, at the very beginning of pitching the series, we had figured out the main contours of the book and roughly what we wanted to have happen. So writing these books then starts with a month of pre-writing where we spend an hour or sometimes as much as 2 hours a day on the phone using Google Docs, shared documents, spreadsheets principally, to outline the book. And there's a little tool he has, which is a spreadsheet, which basically takes your word count and tells you roughly at which point in that manuscript you want your key events to happen. You know, you want your theme kind of stated around this point. You want around here to... And it's a little mechanical, and it's a little bit based on the sort of Hollywood screenplay formula, and you can't follow it slavishly, but it is a great way to start with a structure template to get that book kind of outline, right? So you fill in kind of what are happening, each of those key points, and then you turn that into a 30-line outline, chapter by chapter, where each chapter you say, well, who's the point of view character, here's where it's set, here's what's going to happen, here are additional notes around maybe subplot or things we want to make sure we show. And then we assign each of us 15 chapters, and we just write it. And so we wrote that. The rough draft's 84,000 of the second book we just wrote is 84,000 words. We wrote it in 8 days, and on two of those days I worked all day and could not write at all. So really I wrote my 42,000 words in 6 days. Only possible to do it coherently because we had an outline first that described in every single chapter what was going to happen.
You also write soundtracks for some of your books. Can you tell us about how this process works for you and why you do it?
That's a good question. So it depends. Sometimes the songs come before the stories. Sometimes there are songs that I wrote years ago, and as I'm writing, I see a place to fit them into the story, and so I do. Sometimes, and that may even require me to tinker with the lyric, do a new version. So I'm doing a kind of a filk or a parody of a song I originally wrote for another context. Very often I know that I want to have a song in a place to give additional historical setting background or to kind of set a mood, and so I will write it along with the chapter. It's kind of two notes there. For world building, I love in-world documents as a technique, right? Very often in fantasy, a character will just think a whole bunch of background, or the narrator will just spoon-feed to the reader a whole bunch of background, right? 400 years ago, the kingdom of this and such was overtaken by orcs, and now this, and as a way to just try and give the reader the background information to understand the story. I would rather put that background information into a riddle or a story told by a character within the story to another character, or into an argument the characters have, or into a song characters are singing, because that's how we know things in the real world. And also because that adds an element of uncertainty, which we also experience in the real world. In fact, in the real world, we don't really know objective facts in the way that often in fantasy novels we seem to just all know them because the narrator tells them to us. That's not how it happens. We actually don't agree on the facts, right? You can see this in political discussions all the time, but in other kinds of discussions too. We don't agree on the meaning of the facts, but we don't even agree on what the facts are, right? So you get you create a more realistically imprecise world. And I think B, it's easier and more fun to read. Another kind of note, so I record the songs, and the recorded versions always have more verses than are in the version in the book. I do that for a couple reasons. One is I want to be memorable, and this is an absolutely weird thing to do, and therefore I do it. Two, I love Tolkien, and Tolkien wrote songs, and they had melodies, and there are recordings of him singing some of those songs, right? So here again, as in many other instances, I'm following my first influences. But three, also, it allows me to create things that I can give to people, to readers, beyond just the book. And so people who follow my email mailing list, I'll mail them the songs. You can go buy them in a CD form, but also I just give them away. I have a little card, Drop Card is a website that hosts the whole album for the first book. The second book album, I'm a little overdue. I need to finish it. It's almost done. And so I'll give people, if I meet people and they buy the book, I'll give them a Drop Card and they can go download the album, which means they can hear the songs in their head like I hear them. And it means that here again, there's the in-world documents and they stand apart from the actual book and oh look, there's more backstory, there's more information depth here than just what's on the printed page. And I think that's fun. I think that increases the interest in the story.
What do you see as the future for the interaction between literature and music?
That's a really good question. We see some kinds of audiobooks where increasingly there's music in them. I guess I should wind back and say, look, the interaction between literature and music goes all the way back. You know, our oldest stuff, some of our oldest stuff is sung, whether they're texts that are now incorporated in the Bible, like the Psalms, or the Homeric stuff. You know, the oldest Indian literature and probably also Greek literature was tonal, meaning that they didn't have stress accents, that they were melodic. So Homer wasn't just reciting words, he was singing them, right? Homer, the Homeric poets. So there's always been a connection. I think one of the things that's really fun now is the ability of media, so sort of the ability to have multimedia experiences. There was Neal Stephenson, again, hero of mine, did a collaboration with Greg Bear and others a few years ago called The Mongolian. And I don't think it's still going on now. I'm not sure how long it ran. They wrote stories, and it was about the interaction of Western Europe with the Mongols, right, medievally. And there were stories that you could purchase in book form, but there were also maps, and there were animations, and there were still images, and there was music. And you didn't buy this in a book form. Ultimately, you could, but what you did is you subscribed on an app, and you would get new content for your subscription, and it was all this stuff. And I think that's wonderful, and I think it was ahead of its time. I don't know whether they regard it as a success or as a failure. I think that kind of thing will become more common. And I don't know what it will look like. Maybe it will look like ebooks that have music where you can turn it on, right? Or maybe it will look like books that come with a download code so you can download the soundtrack and listen to it, you know? Well, so there's been a technological and cultural shift. I think we make our own personal music much less. And I think that's a loss. We used to entertain ourselves more by sitting around making music. And another reason I go around making songs and playing them is to sort of show people that it's okay to suck musically, right? That you can have fun still sucking. That's part of what I'm doing. All my kids to know that. But also, we listen to music all the time, right? Because it's recorded, it's ubiquitous, it's cheap. And I think that ubiquity is going to make its way increasingly into the storytelling experience. So I think we see it already in TV shows and movies. I think we're going to see it more in with reading experiences too. So maybe someday someone will look back and say Dave Butler, in his own weird way, was a little bit cutting edge, right? Imitating Tolkien from the 70s, but still, you know, ahead of his time.
What do you see as themes that will become increasingly important in fantasy and science fiction?
That is really, really interesting. So I think science fiction is, at its heart, is the literature of the what-if literature of ideation, ideas. Hey, could we live differently? What if we had a tool that let us do this, right? What if we met another people, you know, another star-faring species? How would that look? And I think that's important. And that's important when you are looking future, and I think that it's important when you are writing dystopic science fiction and looking at it now. I think the reason dystopian literature has been very important in recent years is that we are uncomfortable with the rate of change. And I think the things we're uncomfortable with are what's going to show up more and more in dystopian science fiction. So I think that one of the themes of The Hunger Games is sort of taking reality television to its most brutal extreme, together with the concern that people only want to be entertained, they don't want to be engaged, right? And those two things basically drive The Hunger Games. There is clearly a segment of people who are reading The Handmaid's Tale and who are concerned that society is too interested in controlling their reproductive rights. Now, rightly or wrongly, there's a segment that thinks these things. I look at the news today, and I think people are really concerned about things like privacy and manipulation and trustworthiness of what are putatively the facts. You know, fake news is the cry of all parties on all sides. You're fake news, I mean. I think we ought to see this stuff showing up in dystopian literature and as we try and figure out the consequences. On the fantasy side, you know, fantasy is the what-if literature of the human spirit. I think it's actually been corrupted in the last 20 years by two trends. And one trend is hard magic systems, where people think what I'm doing with fantasy is I'm writing an adventure story in which I have magic. But magic needs to follow real specific rules, and it needs to look a little bit like physics. And so, you know, hey, if I touch a certain color, I can fly. If I touch that color, I can turn invisible. And the basic problem with this is in stepping away from the traditions that are associated with more real-world magic, creating this artificial magic, which really is a simulation of how games work. You step away from the mythological and psychological and sociological roots of the way magic works in traditional literature and in the lives of people historically. And so I think you're depriving fantasy literature of its ability to talk about the human spirit. The other real problem is grimdark literature. Now, grimdark literature does have something to say about the human spirit, but all it says is that there is nothing. It's just nihilism, right? Violence is the order of the day. We are meat and nothing more. And that's fundamentally a juvenile position. That's a kind of a sophomore position. If you say that and you stop there, you're saying nothing, right? If you say that and say, okay, that if that's my premise, now what? Then you rise above grimdark and you're starting to ask questions that kind of lead you down roads like Hobbes and Nietzsche and stuff. But so we have this one sterile and one deeply juvenile trend that dominated fantasy literature. So what I really want to happen is for people to again say, all right, look, this is literature of the unconscious mind and the great symbols of humanity. And I want them to write fantasy of meaning again. Fantasy, and I'm going to say this, I don't mean religious, but spiritual fantasy, right? Writing about the human spirit. That's what that literature is really for. And it's those kinds of stories that literature really belongs to. And that's what I hope will come.
So we've been fortunate enough to have you write a few stories for Simultaneous Times podcast. And you talked a little bit about some projects that you're working on. But now I'd just like to give you an opportunity to talk about any upcoming projects, books that are on the way, or anything interesting you'd like to tell us.
Oh, thanks very much, Jean-Paul. Let me tell you about my two next books. Timing is not always predictable in publishing. I went about a year with nothing out, really. And now in the course of 4 months, I have two novels and four short stories all coming out back to back to back. Let me just tell you about my next two novels. So the first one comes out in November. It's called The Cunning Man. It's an urban fantasy with some of the sort of tropes and structures will feel very familiar if you read Harry Dresden's, Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden books or Patricia Briggs or anyone else, but with some real interesting differences. It's set in rural Utah in 1935, and it is about a sugar beet farmer named Hiram Woolley. This is the book that Aaron Ritchie and I co-wrote. And Hiram is raised at a time of great change and a culture that's rapidly changing. And he, although he lives in the modern world, he's really rooted in the old world, including Hiram grows up working his Grandma Hetty's sugar beet farm and using her traditional magical lore. So, and then in the Great Depression, he has a sort of ministry to help people who are suffering from unemployment. The book one is about a shuttered mine. Right? Squabbling families, fights over wills, whatever. And he discovers behind these problems are demons and cults and curses and malevolent witches, and he fights them using his Grandma Hetty's traditional magical lore. So this is really a story, if you think about this in terms of like sort of D&D vocabulary, this is a story about what does a paladin look like in 1930s America. He's a guy who is really out to help people who need help. And we absolutely, every spell, Hiram Woolley, and he doesn't use those words, actually. He's uncomfortable with the word magic and the word spell. He talks about charms or lore from his Grandma Hetty, but they're all real. Just to say, they're all from written sources. And in particular, a lot of them are from a real-world magical tradition, which were called the cunning folk, cunning women or cunning men, in medieval and early modern England, and we have documentation of them into the 1930s, were sort of your white hat village magicians. And they were people who usually were literate, and they were artisans, they were middle class, they often had a business. So it would be, for example, a gunsmith or a tailor, But out of the back door, he would operate a different kind of business. And you came and said, listen, I'm being bothered by a witch. And he would look into it for you. Or he'd say, well, I can't find, something's been stolen. He would use his craft to figure out who the thief was. So this is about a cunning man in 1930s Utah, trying to get open a mine, which has been basically bottled up by a demon. So that's coming out. That was the book I talked about co-writing. The sequel is written too. We have to edit it. It's called The Jupiter Knife. That comes out early 2021. That was actually especially fun. It's a year and a half from now. But the climax is a knife fight using astrologically enchanted daggers between Hiram Woolley and a Mormon bishop who was also a werewolf, head of a werewolf cult, beneath Delicate Arch in the monument. It wasn't a national park, it was the Arch's National Monument in Utah. So that comes out in November. Then the next thing is fun. This is my... it actually only looks like fantasy, but the novel's called In the Palace of Shadow and Joy. It's set in a setting that looks like Thieves World, the classic Thieves World tales, old, corrupt, decadent city, meets the Mos Eisley Cantina. So there are no elves, there are a proverbial thousand races of men, but they look like all kinds of stuff. It's like the Mos Eisley Cantina scene. You walk in, there's a guy whose head is shaped like a hammerhead shark, and there's a guy with walrus tusks, right? And there's Greedo, and there's like people that aren't even humanoid, right? This is what the setting looks like. And the characters perceive that they are in a world full of magic. They talk about magic and necromancy, but all of the magic you actually see on stage is weird biology. Because this is actually a far future Earth setting. And this is Earth tens of thousands of years in the future, long after a forgotten gene war, which created a multiplicity of varieties of originally related human derivatives, right? And in this old former imperial capital that's now a city totally run by mercenaries and ruled by these seven cutthroat families who were descendants of the last emperor's great servants. It's about two guys who are, they're thinking men. One is an epic poet. He's the last oral poet of his people. He knows all of the oral epithets and he's memorized the entire history, and it's his job to sing their story. And the problem is that they're dying. There are not very many of them left, and none of the survivors, none of the young, want to take on his job. So he's come to the city to try and find a replacement. And the other guy is literate and a relentless self-improver, who's sort of a thug and a black market insurance salesman. And these guys get set up to be the patsies in an insurance scheme. They're supposed to be killed and take the fall. And it's about their effort to survive and then kind of ultimately come together and become a team. I'm excited about that. Those are both, Cunning Man and Palace of Shadow and Joy, are both book ones, a new series from me and from Bain Publishing.
You just heard Simultaneous Times Supplementary Log, an interview with DJ Butler, with music by Red Blue Black Silver. Simultaneous Times is a monthly science fiction podcast going live on the 15th of each month. And now, Simultaneous Times Supplementary Log, interviews with the authors and musicians of the podcast, going live on the 1st of every month. Theme music by Dane Lescombe. Be sure to visit us at our bookstore in Joshua Tree, California, or at spacecowboybooks.com. And out now, Simultaneous Times Volume 1, paperback science fiction anthology, available on our website and on Lulu. Get in touch on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. And now a word from other fellow Joshua Tree podcasters.
Are you looking for a new way to think and transform? Tune into Myth Matters, a bi-weekly podcast of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to life today. Find a more creative way to live. Learn more at mythicmojo.com and keep the mystery in your life alive.
Have you ever wondered why people live in the desert? I'm Dawn Davis, and I host Desert Lady Diaries podcast. It's a weekly conversation with women who found their home in the Mojave Desert. Each week, I talk to women who were either born and raised in the desert or felt called to come here and what the desert means to them. You can learn more about the podcast and listen at DesertLadyDiaries.com.
We live in a very weird place. A dry and mountainous land of poisonous creatures and desert monsters, missing tourists, and strange lights in the sky. Join us every Friday at 10 p.m. for a late-night voyage across the mysterious Mojave Wilderness on KCDZ 107.7.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.